The Future Proof Podcast from News Talk.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland. Hashtag believe in science.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof the Podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. If you'd like to get in touch with the show, you can email us science@newstalk.com or you can find us on Twitter. We're at Newstalk Science. Really appreciate all of your comments and letting people know about the program. Coming up on this week's show, as the Nazis came to power, Jews were increasingly pushed out of society. So how did a gay Jewish scientist manage to thrive under the nose of Hitler? We'll hear the amazing story of Otto Warburg. First, though, it's time to look back, as we always do with the week's science news. And joining me via Skype is Dr. Susan Keller from DCU and from NUI Galway, Dr. Jessamine Fairfield. Our first and second story are sort of related, and they're sort of about the house of the future. So, Susan, we'll start with you. This is an idea, perhaps not that new, of getting electricity from sort of incidental movement, like stepping on paved stones in streets and so on.
Yeah, so this work is coming from ETH Zurich, and they've taken that idea of gathering static electricity from, as you said, when two materials rub off each other. So a really clean example of this is if you take a balloon and you rub your hair, you're going to get static electricity and your hair stands up. Your balloon, the balloon is now attracted to your hair, and your hair is attracted to the balloon, and you get an electric charge. So the researchers in Zurich are looking at doing this with wooden floors. So the hope that when you walk across it, footsteps will be able to create electricity. And in the way that the balloon is able to attract the hair on your head, the researchers have embedded the types of materials that will allow this transfer of charge. So the transfer is a negative charge that leaves your hair and goes to the balloon. And the researchers have embedded wooden floors, or at least wooden wood, with the types of elements that allow this to happen. So they've embedded one piece of wood with what's called PDMS, which is polydimethyl siloxane, which will act like the balloon. Yeah, so it acts like the balloon. And then they embedded another one with zeolithic imidazolate framework, and that acts like your hair. So when you have this wood on a surface and you have those materials in there, you're now going to be able to get charge when you step on it. And they showed, which I think this is really kind of real world stuff, they showed that like a small sample, when it had a foot, like the pressure of a footstep down on top of it of this type of wood, it created 24.3 volts. But they also made an A4 size sheet of this material, and then they actually stepped on it and it powered a light bulb, which, wow, if you think about how it could be used in your home, you know, the electrodes that could take the static electricity and then redistribute it to where it needs to be, it could be the way forward. And one really important thing, because everyone's thinking, this sounds nice, I'd like this in my house, they're also looking at creating coatings so that you could put it on your current wooden floor, because you know, it's not very sustainable. The idea is this could be green, but like not if you have to rip up your floors. So this could be created as a coating that might be able to be retrofitted.
I have to say, I thought when I saw that this was getting power from flooring, I thought it was from the pressure down, which is, I think, how some street lamps are done in the continent. And then when you said it was the wooden floor, I was wondering, were we going to have to wear sort of like slippers in the house or that sort of thing? They do that in the continent, don't they? You know, you go into, yes, someone's house and they give you weird slippers you have to wear. Do you let people wear outdoor shoes in your house, Susan?
No, because I lived in Berlin for a couple of years.
And you're one of those weirdo people.
I am currently wearing slippers.
There you go. Jessamine, I suppose I have to ask you that same question now before we go into your story. Are you a slippers indoor sort of gal?
I am. And we have like a shoe rack by the door. But also all of my college roommates were Asian. And so it was just like, no, absolutely. Why would you ever let anyone wear
I'm
their
filthy, aren't I? I'm the filthy exception to this trio. All right. This story has to do with wireless power, which has been sort of around for quite some time, but it hasn't gotten into our homes. It's hugely exciting. Tell me about this story.
Yeah, so the idea here is, you know, if you could just walk in the front door of your house and have all of your devices, like your phone, laptop, whatever, start charging without you having to do anything, without having to plug anything in, that would be great, right? And some people might have wireless chargers for their phone, which is kind of like a dock where you would just, you know, set your phone down on it and it's able to charge that way. But researchers at the University of Tokyo have now generalized this to a special room they developed that can transmit power wirelessly anywhere in the room up to about 50 watts. to charge small devices like phones, like lamps, fans, that kind of thing. This is really exciting, even though it's sort of the first step of being able to do this in people's actual homes. So what they did is they built a sort of test room, which was about the size of a small freight container, and they put metal panels into the walls and a metal pole down the center of the room. And basically, they were able to run alternating current through these metal pieces to generate a magnetic field throughout the room. And then it's the magnetic field that actually charges. They charge a phone, they charge a lamp, a fan. And it's the same principle as these small wireless charging stands, right? Where you're basically using a metal coil in the device that then turns that magnetic field into a current that the device can then use. So this is basically Faraday's law in action for the physicists. It's important to note now that this big metal box that you go into is not just a big microwave, right? Because microwaves do other things too. The electrical field can have a not so great effect for tissue. I personally would not want to walk into a giant microwave, even if it did charge my phone. But the researchers got around this by putting capacitors into the walls of the room. So basically, the capacitors are storing the electric field so that the stuff inside isn't getting cooked, basically. But the magnetic field is going throughout the volume of the room to charge devices. And these researchers found that the magnetic fields in this room were actually at a what would be considered a safe level for humans, although they didn't put any humans in the room yet. So this is definitely a more testing needed kind of situation.
Yeah.
But it's a really promising first step.
The limitation, of course, is that you have to have the coil in the center of the room. And the only rooms currently that have a pole going straight down the middle that I can think of are strip bars. So, I mean, maybe that's the first implementation of this. And maybe we'll all get around to the idea. But I suppose there are some supporting columns in terms of how we might actually use this in our own homes. Is there a way around having a big lumpy metal pole in the middle of our house, and is that pole and is being in that room perfectly safe for human health as far as we know?
Well, so far in this example, the level of magnetic field that they had throughout the room was definitely safe, or would have been safe for people, but again, they haven't actually tested this yet. But I think what's interesting that you bring up about the pole, right? And they kind of needed the different pieces to get coverage throughout the entire space. Right. So you can imagine you might be able to get away without something like that if you were happy to have, say, only the center of your room charge devices. Like maybe you just have a table and you put stuff on the table and it charges and then you take it away. Or perhaps as Susan was talking about, right, with like existing coatings that you could put onto your existing floors, you know, maybe this could be developed into a paint or something like that that could go on the walls to develop a charging zone rather than having to like actually go in and put metal in all the walls of your house, which probably most people aren't going to do.
Yeah.
So it'll be interesting to see the direction that this goes.
Really interesting stuff. It would be great to walk into a room, not have to think about it, and have your phone charge automatically. It sounds like such a third world problem, but it is useful. Our third story has to do with kidney stones, Susan.
Yeah, thankfully, something I'm not too familiar with, which is, you know, lucky. But they do cause a lot of, you know, pain for people, and they can be very complicated to get rid of if they get over, you know, if they get too large. So
they come out your willy, right?
You're a willy.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Well,
you pass them in your urine. So they form in your urinary tract. And basically what happens is, you know, there's lots of salt and minerals in your urine. And then if it's really too concentrated, that salt and minerals starts to clump together and you start to form these stones. Now, if they're small, that's not a big problem. But when they got large, they can cause blockages, they can cause pain, and then they really need to be surgically removed. So this work looks at understanding the formation of these stones, and they've looked towards geology because there are other types of stones. And it's really a nice project because they've taken what's called a microfluidic device where they can do this outside the body, where they can show the formation of these kidney stones in real time. That allows for lots of microscopy to be done at every stage of formation. And that's not easy, obviously, when it's internal. Usually you could have a look at them when they've come out after surgery, but being able to follow it and map it in real time is amazing. And what they've shown using lots of different software that they've taken from geology, this biomineralization process, they're able to look at, say, the strata, you know, how it's formed, the crystallization of the stone, and then the different architectures of it and why it grows a certain direction or changes shape. And what they've also spotted that they hadn't seen before was that when they start to form, they actually dissolve a little bit and then reform and then dissolve and reform and dissolve and reform. And this is kind of like the stalagmites that you might see in, you know, the Alawi caves or whatever. This is a type of, you know, dripping of water and the concentration of ions that allows the thing to be formed. But the dissolving wasn't seen before. And now they think that this could be a way forward to, you know, if they understand how they're formed and the dissolving, to be able to remove them without surgery, which is a big thing for this area, because they were thought to be pretty impossible in the body. You'd have to get some really strong acids in there, which you wouldn't be wanting to do.
Not ideal.
So it's just, I like it as a story from that kind of multidisciplinary nature of medicine meets biology meets geology. So it's a really nice piece of work.
Very good. Our final story, Jessamine, has to do with these amazing phenomena out in the universe, neutron stars. Every time I hear about these things, I'm blown away by the sheer stats of them.
Yeah, neutron stars are insane. And this is basically new research that's come out of the University of Southampton looking at the roundness of neutron stars. But what a neutron star is it's basically the collapsed core of a supergiant star. So it would be something that's a similar kind of mass to our sun, maybe like 1 to 2 solar masses, but in a much, much, much smaller area. So the diameter of a neutron star might be about 10 kilometers, you know, the distance from the Liffey to Dublin Airport, basically, but with the entire mass of our sun jammed in there. Mm. And what's cool about them from a physicist's perspective, right, is that basically, they're called neutron stars because they're just effectively a huge sea of neutrons, right? So all of the protons and electrons that make up normal matter have just sort of fused into these neutrons. And the neutron star itself is basically just sitting there at approximately the density of atomic nuclei. You know, so normally an atom would have this very, very dense nucleus then surrounded by this kind of spacious electron cloud. Yeah. And here we just have this massive object that's just the density of nuclei.
And actually, just to build on that visual image, I think it's, you know, when we think of atoms in our normal daily life, as you say, most of everything that we see and touch is empty space. And there's only a tiny bit of so-called matter, the electron and the proton and all the other bits. And in these neutron stars, you basically just crunch everything down into that. So it's all stuff like packed together in a flat pack. And it's amazing to think about it.
Yeah, it's really incredible. And it also means, you know, the gravity on the surface of a neutron star would be about 200 million times stronger than the gravity on the surface of Earth, right? Because there's just so much mass there in such a small space. So gravity is really, really strong. And this is part of why they're incredibly round objects, right? Because this is why most things are round in the universe, stars, planets, because gravity is sort of pulling them into this spherical shape. A lot of things like our planet, our sun, and also to some extent neutron stars would have a kind of like fatter midsection due to rotation. But neutron stars are incredibly round because they have this incredibly high gravity. So basically what this new research is looking at is how exactly round are neutron stars. And previous models had kind of looked at, okay, if we had a mountain on a neutron star, what would it look like? You know, how tall would it be? And this new model from the University of Southampton has basically found that the mountains, I'm using air quotes here for our radio listeners, are only a few millimeters high. So again, this is on like a 10 kilometer size object. So really, really incredibly close to being like perfectly spherical, which is just amazing. And as you said, they're just such a weird type of material. Like it's really nothing that we could make here on Earth. And that's one reason why it's so interesting to scientists to study these, because it really pushes the boundary of what we understand about matter.
Yeah. One of the facts that really stuck with me was that a teaspoon of this stuff of a neutron star would be about 350,000 Eiffel Towers, 4 billion tons in a teaspoon of neutron star. And that these things are spinning at ridiculous rates as well. So you imagine this giant sort of mini moon spinning at incredible speeds and sucking in everything within its gravitational field. It's a really cool thing to think about. Thanks so many for that, Dr. Jessamine Fairfield from NUI Galway, and from DCU, Dr. Susan Callagher. Thanks very much. Now, as we know, the first people to be overcome and subjugated by the Nazis were the German people themselves. And in the year prior to World War II, as Hitler consolidated power and set out to eradicate any and all of those deemed to be inferior to his notion of Aryan supremacy, millions fled. But not everyone. And some would-be outcasts thrived in Hitler's Germany despite their genes and because of their brains. Sam Apple is on the faculty of the MA in Science Writing and MA in Writing programs at Johns Hopkins, and he is also author of Ravenous, Otto Warburg, The Nazis, and the Search for the Cancer Diet Connection. He joins me now. Welcome to the program, Sam. Perhaps you might take us back to the turn of the 20th century and explain where Germany stood in the scientific community.
Sure. Thank you for having me. Germany really stood at the pinnacle of the scientific world in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. German unification had happened in the second half of the 19th century, and there was a very rapid industrialization, and German science and industry were really thriving. You saw this first and foremost in the tremendous progress made against infectious diseases, where Robert Koch and other leading German figures were sort of making connections between specific microorganisms and diseases. And it really, led to rapid progress in preventing infectious illnesses. But it wasn't just that, it was really across, physics, famously mathematics, chemistry, as we'll talk about more. So, really was a tremendous flowering of science. I think unlike anything that has existed since, you can look at the, the first few dozen Nobel Prize winners, shocking percentage are German.
Mm. Yeah, and not just German, but also German with Jewish roots. Einstein, Meyerhoff, Haber, and this chap, Otto Warburg, who we'll talk about. Who was he, and what was his interest in science?
Sure. So Warburg is the son of Emil Warburg, who is a very distinguished physicist, one of the few Jewish physicists to have a full professorship at the University of Berlin, very prominent figure who works with Einstein. Einstein loves him in part because he provides experimental evidence for some of Einstein's theories. And Warburg grows up in a home where all these personalities that you just mentioned and others are regular visitors. Emil Fischer, the famous chemist, Einstein, of course, Haber, Max Planck, and on and on. And so, he really grows up expecting to be a great scientist. And, he's a teenager when they introduced the Nobel Prizes, but I think he very much just assumed that he would one day win a Nobel Prize. He said that he couldn't imagine anybody living a life that wasn't devoted to science. It was, every aspect, every waking moment of his early life was spent thinking about science and thinking about what great discovery he would make.
And as we said, Hitler rises to power on this notion of white supremacy and Aryan supremacy. Very much made it an unwelcome place, to say the least, for Jewish people in the run-up to World War II. Many fled. Einstein left, Haber left. This was not a place where Jews were obviously welcome, but he stayed. Why was that?
Yeah, so we arrive at 1933, and Warburg wins the Nobel Prize in 1931. And that same year, he has this beautiful institute built for him with money from the Rockefeller Foundation. So he really has, a dream life for a scientist, a team of people working beneath him that will do whatever experiment he wants. And, the Nazis come to power and say, you're not full Germans, to the Jewish population, you're not welcome. And, it's astonishing to them. Many of these people, including Warburg, served with honor and distinction in World War I. They thought of themselves as German patriots and heroes. They had contributed to the war effort. They were, celebrated scientists internationally. And it just seemed unthinkable that these people would come in and tell them to leave. And, many people, saw what was coming and left quickly. Einstein saw it before anybody else and didn't even return to Germany once he saw that the Nazis had taken power. But Warburg was not unique in thinking that it was going to be a short-lived phenomenon, that, it would burn out in a year or two and everything would return to normal.
And it would have been so much for him to give up had he fled, of course.
Yeah. I think it's very understandable, at least at the beginning, that he didn't want to give it all up. But, other special thing about Warburg is that he was, you know, just a tremendously arrogant, conceited person. And the thought of somebody else telling him what to do, let alone, you know, he referred to Nazis as low lice and thugs. If these people are going to come in and tell him that he wasn't a German was unthinkable. And so they would come to his institute and he would literally shout at them and, you know, refuse to give the Nazi salute. And, you know, one instance say, I'm going to burn down my institute if you ever come back here again. And, you know, just outrageous behavior that so easily could have gotten him in trouble. You know, this is already, you know, by the time he's doing this in the early 30s, they're sending political prisoners into these concentration camps. You know, they're not yet death camps, but they are places where people die, and it's extremely risky behavior. So it's just incredible that he behaved this way and put his own life in jeopardy.
He must have known his worth in some way. You said he won the Nobel Prize, but we haven't really talked about his science. What was he famous for? What did he win the prize for? And why did the Nazis want to keep him around?
Sure. So, you know, much of my book, Ravenous, is actually about his cancer research. But he won the Nobel Prize in 1931 for his work on cellular breathing. You know, it was related to his cancer research, but it was sort of a discovery of how enzymes process nutrients and oxygen to give us, you know, the energy for life. So he sort of, you know, made a key discovery about how cellular breathing works. But, you know, he was also well known for his cancer research, and he had discovered that cancer cells take up a lot of glucose and break it down in this unusual way rather than burning it with oxygen, as you would expect that growing, you know, cells would need to do. Instead, they use this inefficient process, which is essentially fermentation, the same process that microorganisms use. And it means taking up a lot of glucose and just quickly turning it into lactic acid or alcohol for other organisms, alcohol and carbon dioxide. So it was very strange that cancer cells are fermenting. And it was sort of a revolutionary new way to think about cancer as a metabolic problem. And the Nazis were very interested in Warburg's research because they were very interested in cancer. As we talked about before, they were at the top of the scientific world. They had conquered all these other diseases, but they couldn't make any progress against cancer. And Warburg looked to, you know, be a way forward.
Was this something that Hitler was concerned about, cancer in the modern world and cancer for Germans?
Absolutely. People like Warburg and Hitler, who grew up around the same time in the late 19th century, had seen progress against infectious diseases. But at the same time, cancer was becoming more and more common. It was, you know, reaching these epidemic levels after having once been a relatively uncommon disease, you know, a century earlier, certainly. And Hitler then, you know, has this personal experience where his mother gets breast cancer. And it comes at a very important moment in his life where he's just been rejected from art school, and he's by his mother's side watching her dying, and he's absolutely distraught. It's actually a Jewish doctor who takes care of his mother, and he spends a lot of time with Hitler, and they seem to have a very good relationship. And the Jewish doctor said he's never seen a human being more distraught than what he saw in Hitler's face during that period. And so it clearly has a huge influence on Hitler's thinking. You know, for the rest of his life, I think you can fairly say obsessed with cancer. Comes up in his speeches all the time, you know, not just as a metaphor in the way that, you know, lots of people use cancer as a metaphor, but repeatedly discussing it, asking about research and on and on. So it makes sense that Warburg would have received special attention, but you have to remember that Warburg is not only, you know, not only has a Jewish father, but has the last name Warburg is the most famous Jewish name in Germany. It's a famous banking family. And he's gay. Not, I wouldn't say openly, because no one was really openly gay, but about as open as you could be.
You know, so it was known at that time that he was a gay Jew that was kicking the Nazis out of his institute and making threats. Yeah. Wow.
It's just, you know, if anybody had cause for fear, it was Warburg. But, you know, it did help at the very beginning that he was only had one Jewish parent rather than two. And it did help at the very beginning that he had served as World War One. They made some exceptions. But as time went on, you know, there were no more exceptions, and time really was running out on him. And, you know, in 1941, he's finally called into Nazi headquarters, and it looks like it's the end of him. He's been given an eviction notice from his institute, but he sits down with these top SS officials, and they actually tell him, you know, we're going to let you continue. We're actually going to give you more funding in the end. But, you know, the condition is that he has to focus on cancer. But the really incredible thing about this is the day he's called in, it's June 21st, 1941. And it's later that night, you know, at dawn, that the Nazis launch Operation Barbarossa. They risk the entire Nazi project only hours later, rolling, you know, the tanks eastward into the Soviet Union. And yet only hours before, they're having meetings about Warburg. Himmler meets to discuss Warburg that day. Later that night in Goebbels' diary, you see that he and Hitler are talking about cancer. So it's just amazing that even at the most critical moments, they're focused on cancer.
Wow. It's kind of strange in a way, because cancer, of course, is not an immediate threat in the same way as the Allies were. That it would be of such a pressing subject is fascinating. I was going to ask you, was there documentation of Warburg receiving this special attention? But I guess if he's having meeting with the brass about his future, then it was very clear they were thinking about him. In the earlier days, when Nazis were knocking on his door, was there any evidence that he had been ring-fenced? And were there other scientists like that who were sort of ring-fenced and their, as Hitler saw it, undesirable background ignored to get access to their expertise?
Yeah, well, you know, in the early 30s, you know, there already start to be problems. Warburg can no longer apply for a license to even get ethanol for his laboratory unless he signed a form saying that he's an Aryan, which he can't do because he's not a true Aryan. And then, you know, as things progress, he still gets, you know, some funding in the 1930s. But, you know, as things progress, no other scientists want anything to do with him, you know, partially because, you know, just associating with him was a risk, you know, to their own livelihood in Nazi Germany. And, you know, many of the other scientific institutes of this Kaiser Wilhelm Society, you know, had leading Nazis in them, you know, people that would, you know, proudly salute and hang the Nazi flags. So, you know, it was dangerous to be around Warburg. He used to have all these international students come and he couldn't get them to come anymore by the late 30s.
When it comes to the science, I know that there were some awful experiments that the Nazi performed on humans to test pain thresholds and so on. In Warburg's work, he didn't do any of that, right? He didn't use prisoners for his research or anything like that. There's no evidence of that.
Right, right. Yeah, he was a, you know, just doing laboratory research, yeah. You know, animal studies but not anything related to human. And he's never been accused, and I found no evidence that he in any way contributed to the Nazi war effort or Nazi science.
Because cancer was this resurging, mysterious disease, was there a prevailing theory as to what caused it? And was Warburg working on the causes of it? Was he much more focused on what's happening in these cells?
Both. I mean, he was, you know, doing experiments and he was, you know, a brilliant researcher who, you know, was uniquely capable in the lab and devising new scientific tools. But he was also a theorist who tried to explain his experiments. And that's where he tended to get into trouble. So one of the leading hypotheses of the early, you know, 20th century and late 19th century was that cancer was caused by a microorganism, you know, much like the infectious diseases that had been understood, tuberculosis, anthrax, et cetera. So everybody was hunting for this microbe, and Warburg comes along and says, no, it's actually not a bacterium. It's actually our cell, our own cell, but it's behaving, you know, like bacteria. It's eating in the manner of a fermenting microorganisms. It's eating like yeast. That was one of the first things he said in his first big paper on cancer, that cancer behaves like yeast. So the question is, you know, why would a cancer cell ever do this? And this was, you know, continues to be debated to this day. Warburg's hypothesis was that it had to be a problem with how a cell uses oxygen, because that's a better way to use energy. Cancer cells need energy to grow. You know, why wouldn't they use oxygen and burn it in the mitochondria if they could? You know, the mitochondria is often called the power station of the cell. Instead, you know, they turn to fermentation, which I use the analogy of a backup generator. Warburg always thought in aristocratic terms. He thought of fermentation as lower and, you know, less distinguished than respiration with oxygen. So he thought there had to be some sort of mechanical breakdown that forced a cell to do this. And some scientists still believe this, but that idea has fallen out of favor somewhat.
He was obviously a fascinating character and an amazing scientist. What is his scientific legacy, would you say?
I think that, you know, it's really a tremendous legacy. I focus on cancer because, you know, that's the topic of my book. And there's been this tremendous rediscovery of the metabolism of cancer cells and how important it is to the early stages of cancer. You know, we've had all these discoveries since the 1970s about oncogenes, these genes that cause cancer. And what these scientists who have recently rediscovered Warburg's research have discovered that these oncogenes are actually the very genes that control metabolism. So, you know, it's been this sort of great synthesis of the old biochemistry with the new molecular biology. But that's really only one part of it. And Warburg made enormously important discoveries in photosynthesis and respiration and general sort of, you know, he really invented, you know, much of the sort of basic biochemistry and study of enzymes that we now take for granted, you know, that led to countless other experiments. You know, Hans Krebs, his student who went on to win the Nobel Prize, you know, learned how to study respiration and metabolic processes standing by Warburg's side. So it's just an enormous legacy.
Well, the book is called Ravenous Otto Warburg, The Nazis and the Search for the Cancer Diet Connection. The author is Sam Apple. Really great speaking with you, Sam. Thanks for your time.
Thank you very much for having me.
I have to say, I love that. I love that period of history, just hearing about it and how a nation got enthralled with an idea so twisted and sick. I mean, it just seems, when I was growing up, it just seemed like it was just a crazy thing to have happened. Like, how could have humanity, such a large, prosperous country, have turned in such a scary way? And yet we're seeing sort of remnants of that now. Producer Aidan McKelvey joins me to go through some of your comments from last week. Why are me and others so fascinated with the Nazis, Aidan, and that period? We just constantly make movies and films and books, and we just seem to be obsessed with that horrible time in our history.
Yeah, well, yeah, as I said, you and everybody else, it's kind of got everything. It's got like all sorts of dramatic conflicts, and it completely shapes. We kind of forget it completely shapes the world we live in today. We're a little bit detached from it being Irish, but particularly if you're in Europe or you're in England, you see just how pervasive the ideas that come from the Second World War and after the Second World War are today. We just take them for granted. But like things like the EU, the UN, knowing people from different countries and being friends with them, they're all sort of things that necessarily weren't as much the case before World War II. We're kind of living in the reaction to that.
Yeah. And I suppose it's one of those conflicts that has a real clear bad guy. You know, it's definitely a right side and a wrong side to be on in that war.
There's a right side and a wrong. There's a right side. There's a better side and a worse side to be on. Nice. I wouldn't say, as a historian, I wouldn't say it's as clear as, you know, there's lots, like in any war, lots of bad things done on both sides.
Oh, no, but I mean, the ideas of the Nazis and the idealism, the elitism, like that as an idea that one type of people is better than another, that's just a bad idea. And there's often not such clear-cut bad ideas in wars, I find.
Yeah, isn't it they call the historians, well, not historians, but often the First World War is called the Great War, and the Second World War is called the Good War, which seems quite strange when we're talking about war. But I think the First World War is great as in large. Yeah. And the Good War is good as in it's a little clearer. World War One is very confusing for everybody, but World War Two is a bit clearer.
Right, it's time to go through some of the comments from last week, and we were talking about a robot pill that by magnets managed to find its way to deliver insulin. Really quite a clever device. Micheál O'Flaherty says, this delivery system seems very complicated compared to an insulin pump. I only need to change the needle every 3 days on my pump and it gives me much more control. A possible application could be people with special needs who won't tolerate having a needle on their skin. I mean, I can see most people, I think, who live with diabetes and manage it, you know, with a pump or with a device, I think, you know, you just get used to anything. But I suppose it's for any improvement. If they manage to nail this, you know, taking a pill is presumably less cumbersome, less stigmatized, unfortunately. But it you know, if you could do that and get the exact results you want, then that's an improvement, I would have thought. But I totally see how Michal's sort of saying they're solving a problem that doesn't need to be fixed.
Yeah, so it's also though, the new system is really, really cool. like really cool.
It's cool. It's overly complicated and cool. Kevin says, don't people already have machines that regulate insulin? There are things that you can wear for sure, and they monitor and they send information to your app, but it still needs management. I mean, all of these things, this also needs management and monitoring. But as Aidan says, part of it is an interesting proof of concept. But if they nail it, taking a pill every day, as people now do for HIV, makes it a very manageable, you know, simple condition, which is, I suppose in some ways it is. Going round and round in circles here, Aidan, so we're going to move on. We were talking also about habits and how to break them. Someone says nicotine and alcohol are drugs, so they're addictions, not habits. They're legal because cigarettes save on pension, and alcohol causes depression, a big pharma money spinner. Plus, they're two of the biggest bribers, lobbyists of governments in the world. Speak plainly. I think nicotine and alcohol are drugs. I think it's fair to say. And is an addiction not also a habit? Does habit
the line
imply...
Yeah, is greater.
Yeah. I'm not entirely sure that... I think what you're saying is we allow people to drink alcohol and get depressed because that makes money for big pharma. Gotta say, I'm not fully convinced with that argument, I'd say. But thanks for your comments. And on MITS, we had this really interesting fella on last week, Patrick Nunn, who had a lovely speaking voice, I have to say. I do like a good speaking voice, Aidan. And he was talking about how these ancient myths and legends from, you know, global culture often, you know, cover these large monsters or these mythical beings or these mythical events. And he's saying, you know what, maybe there's some science in that. Maybe there's some actual real events that happen that have sort of transformed into myth and legend because that's how you pass it across the information. And Owen says, hi Jonathan, long time listener, first time emailer. Oh, I love those. I love that first line. Full disclosure, a few years ago I began listening because I thought Off the Ball started at 12. Great. But
funnily enough, that's exactly how I started listening as
oh,
well.
Oh, really? No way. But I've been hooked ever since, he says. I actually downloaded Countdown recently after your talk with Dr. Swan and listened to the whole book in 3 days. Wow, brilliant. Anyway, I was very interested in your discussion about some ancient myths rooted in scientific fact, and I really think you should look at some of Graham Hancock's books, Fingerprints of the Gods, Magicians of the Gods, and look to get him on the show. He's done some great work in this space. Keep up the good work. Our producer, Aidan, is always 3 steps ahead of me on this. So I presume you've both vetted Graham Hancock, discovered whether or not he's appropriate for the show, and if so, booked him.
I'm afraid I have some bad news on the Graham Hancock front, or Graham Hancock, as I believe he likes to be known. He does have some very interesting ideas, but when I started did my master's in history, what got me started was a book by a guy called Gavin Menzies. I think the book was called, it's a year, it was like 1341 or something. And it was about how the Chinese had actually circumnavigated the planet before Magellan and Elcano. But it was a very interesting book. It got me interested in the subject. But I found out when I did my master's that there was a lot of leaps that had been taken, leaps of reasoning. And I'm afraid Graham Hancock might fall into the same bracket. His kind of theories are like, there's a little bit of evidence here of like a kind of a questionable bit of evidence, and he'll build up a whole story about how there were people in the Americas like 200,000 years ago, not based on a lot of evidence, but a bit of conjecture and a bit of a leap. So I'm afraid, as interesting as this stuff is, I'm not sure it warrants a place on the show.
Oh man, you could have just said, oh yeah, we'll look into it. Like, wouldn't that have saved Owen's blushing? I mean, I've already given his surname and everything. And you did a bit of a my book is better than your book thing there. So I don't know. Owen, we're going to get Graham. Owen, we're going to put Graham on the show. Guaranteed. Someday.
I just didn't want Owen to be hoodwinked the way I was hoodwinked. Don't go do a master's on the Americas 200,000 years ago, Owen, okay?
It seems like when do you just like throw a dart at a wall of ideas for a master's, or are you not supposed to figure out whether or not you're researching rubbish before you begin a presumably 2-year path in academia?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I did I started off going, oh, this is an interesting period. And then I was like, exploration. I like that. I'll try that. And then I realized, okay, well, I can't do the Chinese exploration at that time because all of that was nonsense. Oh, right. So I'll do a different element of exploration at that time.
I must look that master's up. Is it legible? In the way, like when you're a student, you use really unnecessarily big words to show that you're smart. Is it full of that?
No, I don't think so. I think it's good. It's like
I'm not going to read it. You didn't sell it to me.
Well, it's like masters in general are quite boring because they're structured in a certain way. So I'd love to. I can give it to you if you want.
Not my thesis, man. My thesis was fascinating, which is why it marked so badly. It was too good be a good, like a well-marked thesis. Right. We could wax lyrical about our academic failures any day, but let's leave it at
and
that,
often
shall we?
Do.
Aidan, thanks very much. That's it from us for this week's programme. Thanks to Aidan McKelvey, producer, Simon Keane, Garrett Mahal, JJ Clark, and Steve McLoon, who was on sound. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday, which is Aidan.
It is Anil Seth on being yourself, on consciousness, basically.
Yeah, very good. That is a good piece, actually. Aidan McKelvey, thanks. Chat to you soon. And everyone else, see you on Tuesday. In the meantime, stay curious.